just one of them at the very beginning.
Gopaika Viro. Viro means powerful, and Gopta means to protect. Goptritve Varanam Tava. It's one of the six limbs of surrender, is to understand that the personality of Godhead is my protector. Goptritve Varanam Tava. From Padma Purana. So, Gopta means protect. So, the Supreme Lord is my protector. That's a consciousness or a mood of a surrendered soul. The Lord is my protector. And then there are representatives of the Lord, that's mentioned in the verse, it's in the same line. Gopaika Viro Naradeva. Naradeva, God amongst men. Nataha. Nata means Lord, like Jagannatha, the Lord of the universe. Jagat, Lord of the universe, Lord Jagannath. But Nata means Lord, or Dwarkanath, the Lord of Dwarka. Natha means Lord. But who's entitled to be considered Lord? And the answer is, that person who is considered that way is the person who is the proprietor of something. Like Jamuna Jeevan is starting to study with the young men on Sundays, Sri Ishopanishad. The Triyashupanishad starts with the invocation mantra that everything comes from the Absolute Truth. And those things that come from the Absolute Truth, they're complete in themselves because they come from the Absolute Truth. But he's the maintainer of those things. They're his, he maintains them, he's the proprietor. And we're not the proprietor because things don't come from us. We're not the maintainer. We're not the source of everything. We're not lords. But a king, ideal king mentioned, that small word, ideal king. But the ideal king sees himself as the instrument of the supreme protector. So he doesn't protect independently. He protects on behalf of the Supreme Lord. It's not a small thing. It's a very important thing. Anything that we do, whatever the feature of what we call responsible life, we're responsible for our family, or responsible for our children, or responsible for the deity, is responsible for the temple, responsible for whatever it is, taking care of our devotional service, taking care of our paraphernalia for sankirtan, responsible. We do that in Krishna consciousness with the understanding that on behalf of the Supreme Lord I'm doing. He's the Nata, he's the proprietor, and I'm doing a service on his behalf. And therefore, a person, the Vedic culture, Prabhupada is explaining, the Vedic culture is such a person, because of, by dint of their Krishna consciousness, is to be considered in a special regard. But we respect the Vaishnavas because they have that consciousness. They do what they do, whatever it is that they do, as a service unto the Supreme Lord. So, as he is protector, they're protectors. Not utilizers, but protectors. Prabhupada gives reference to this discussion with Sanatan Goswami, the expanded narration from Chaitanya Charitamrita, was Sanatan Goswami never really had interest in government. He did so only to protect the devotees of the Lord, because the nasty King Nawab Hussein Shah said to Sanatan Goswami, "Here's, you have two choices. Either you assist me in the government, or I'll torment and torture and kill all the sadhus in the land. Think about it. Tell me what you'd like to do." So he had no interest in government service, but he did it for that reason, to protect. But his interest in government service diminished and diminished and diminished as his spiritual interests grew and grew and grew. So at some point he just stopped coming to the government office, or wherever he went, the palace or whatever, the place where he did his ruling, with the explanation that he's not feeling well. So the Nawab sent a royal physician to examine him and found him perfectly well. So he put two and two together and said, he's playing hooky, he's making an excuse to not come. So he just personally went to see Sanatan Goswami and confront him. And when he went, there were all these brahmanas who were reciting the Vedas and discussing with Sanatan Goswami very happily. So he asked Sanatan Goswami, he just like got right to the point, "What's your intention? You intend to help me in my government or not?" And Sanatan Goswami said, "You're the Naradeva, you're the king, and you may punish me as you wish, because that's your right. You find me guilty of whatever you want, and you can reprimand me or punish me as you wish, but I'm not prepared to continue in government service. I quit." So the Nawab put him in prison, because he didn't want to kill him, because maybe he'll change his mind, and so I'll just put him in prison for a while. That's what the king decided to do. But by Vedic culture, although Nawab Hussein Shah was not a polished man by any means, he was not a representative of God, he was a brute. But by Vedic culture, he respected him in that way. Another example, Lord Chaitanya spoke like that to Gopinath Patanayak. One of five brothers who were very dear to the king, King Prataparudra, he put Gopinath in charge of tax collecting. And Gopinath took advantage of the friendship of the king, and he was collecting the taxes, and he was supposed to keep a certain percentage and give the balance, and he kept more than what he should have kept and gave the balance. And the son of the king Prataparudra was the king's name, and the son's name was Purushottam Jana. So Purushottam came to know that Gopinath was skimming money from the king. And so he went to confront the prince. He's not the king, but he went to confront Gopinath and said, "Come on, pay up. You're stealing money of the king." And Gopinath said, "I don't have the money right now." But so he didn't deny that he was skimming. He just said, "I don't have the money right now, but I'll immediately give you some horses that are very suitable for the king's use, and just give me a fair price, and I'll give you the balance later." And so the prince, Purushottam, made an estimate of the value of the horses, and it was a low price, the underpriced value for the horses. And Gopinath said to the prince something not very nice. He said, "Why have you given such a low price for the horses? They don't move their neck like this, like you do." He insulted Purushottam on top of stealing money from the king. So Purushottam was, "I'm going to get him." So he went to the king and said, "Gopinath is not, he's skimming. He's not giving the full amount that he should be giving to the royal treasury." And the father said, "Well, do what's necessary and get the money. It belongs to the king, it belongs to the royal treasury." With that word from his father, Purushottam went over the top. He found him guilty of stealing from the king and planned to execute him. Death penalty. And so he was put on a changa. Changa is like a wooden platform beneath which there are swords, and then they remove the wooden platform and he falls on the swords and he's dead. You know, in a public place so anyone can see, don't steal from the king, this is what's going to happen to you. So he's Gopinath standing on the changa, and the people that knew the family and knew their connection with Lord Chaitanya went wailing and crying, "Lord Chaitanya, Gopinath is going to be killed because he got in a little argument, a little tiff with Gopinath Patanayak, with Purushottam, the king's son, and do something, save him, their family is very dear to you." And Lord Chaitanya said, "It's the duty of a devotee, when given some service, to carry out nicely, and Gopinath is stealing money from the king. And the king has every right, according to what he deems fit, to punish those who violate the law of the land. And he's taking the money and using it for sense gratification." I mean, specifically said, seeing society girls. And so he deserves to be punished. And it's up to the king to decide how he should be punished. It's fitting. And don't bring stuff like this to me, or I'll leave Puri. So again, Lord Chaitanya was confirming the king is to be seen in that way, the representative. Of course, that's a qualified, or help us using a stronger word, ideal king. An ideal king is to be seen as a representative of God. And that's a small matter that the king is supposed to act that way too. The king is supposed to act, just like it's so many other examples in Vedic culture where respect should go to a certain person. The brahmana should be respected. But the brahmana then has to behave like a brahmana. Not by birth only, or by name only, or by thread only, but by qualification. Or a Vaishnava, etc. The parent is to be respected by the child. The husband is to be respected by the wife. The teacher is to be respected by the student. But each of those who are to be respected are to be qualified, or go stronger, ideal. That doesn't mean, oh, my teacher is not ideal, so I'll disrespect them. My parents are not ideal, so I'll disrespect them, etc. Lord Chaitanya is teaching, Sanatana Goswami was teaching, through their example, we're being taught, even the person may not be the ideal person, fit, worthy of being a representative of God, Narada Deva. The culture is to respect We may discriminate and, you know, conduct ourselves accordingly, but culture is to be there, respect is to be given. In the case of Prithu, he was qualified. So the citizens respected him because he was worthy of their respect, and they were trained in Vedic culture, and so they knew what culture was. Part of the problem is not knowing what culture is. This is especially true in the West, and now it's becoming true worldwide. The culture of no culture is America, and now increasingly so the world, in favor of something else: economic development and sense gratification, artha and kama minus dharma. At any cost, by hook or by crook, as they say. Beg, borrow, or steal, but get ghee. Get the product of economic development. Charvak Muni. So, that's not a new principle, but it's ever more prevalent in Kali Yuga. So the Bhagavatam is an antidote to Kali Yuga. It's giving us indication of what a person, say, in a position of king or president or head of state, then come down and do, you know, whatever level of taking responsibility for others, there's qualifications, and there's qualifications of the followers, and there's qualifications of the leaders. And the other point is, because there's two paragraphs here, the other point that's brought out is this last word, yatarakaha. Yata means like, and arkaha is the sun. So like the sun, that dakshinataha, that travels from the south. What does that mean? The sun that travels from the south. The sun, the point that Prabhupada is emphasizing is the sun moves. Now, we'll do a little comparison between Western astronomy and Vedic astronomy, or cosmology. Western cosmology says our solar system is with the sun at the center and it doesn't move, and the planets move around the sun. And there's two motions of the planets that move around the sun. One is like the Earth planet. This is like eighth grade science. But there's an axis of the Earth, and it's not straight up and down. It's at a 23 and a half degree axis. And the Earth spins. And as the Earth is spinning, day and night occur because the Earth is spinning. In 24 hours, the Earth turns on its axis, and that's the measure of time. And then in relation to the sun, its time is a measurement of the relation of the Earth to the sun. And then there are seasons, because not only the Earth spins in a, if you're looking at it from the top, it spins in a counterclockwise direction, but it moves, at least according to Western cosmology, it moves clockwise around the sun. And because here's the sun and here's the Earth with its axis tilting, because the axis stays, although the Earth is spinning, it moves in a clockwise direction around the sun, therefore we have seasons. That's the Western modern cosmology, at least, you know, as far as our universe is concerned. The sun is stationary and the Earth moves around the sun in a clockwise direction, and it spins in a counterclockwise direction. So the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west because the sun, the earth is spinning in a clock. If you're looking at it from the top, it spins in a counterclockwise direction, so the sun is rising in the east and setting in the west. That's the western, that's the modern one. The Vedic picture is a different picture. It's a geocentric model, where the earth is not exactly stationary. The earth is also moving, but the whole thing is moving, but as the earth is spinning, and also the sun is moving around the earth. It's just relative motion. And it describes in the fifth canto like an axle that has a wheel at the end of the axle, and as the axle turns around the central pivot place, the wheel is turning and turning and turning and turning, and that's the sun. The sun is moving like a wheel at the end of an axle that moves in a circular motion around the earth, that the orbit of which takes 1 year. And it moves from the southern position to the northern position, and it works this way. Here's the geocentric model. The earth has an axis, 23.5 degrees. And the northern hemisphere is pointed in that direction. And the calculation starts from Makara Sankranti, where from the northern hemisphere perspective, the days are shortest and the nights are longest because the sun is over here and the northern hemisphere is over there. But as the sun starts to move from whatever is January 14th or something, the sun starts to move from the southern direction to the northern direction. So if you put the axis up this way, the sun is moving up, 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 and crosses the equator, where days and nights are equal, and up, 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 into the northern hemisphere, the longest day of the summer, whatever it is, June 21st, and then it starts moving in a southerly direction. Then it crosses the equator again as another equinox, day and nights are equal, and going down, 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 down. And then up, 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 up. And just in the course of a year, the sun is moving, according to Vedic cosmology, at the speed of, it says, 16,000 miles per second. Because, you know, you can do the math. They do the math. It tells, like, you know, how long the axle is. And, you know, so then there's, geometry. There's the radius of the circle, and it takes 1 year to go around, so then they can calculate the speed, how fast it's moving, to make the cycle in 1 year. And you do the math, and, you know, so the distance between the earth and the sun, interestingly, matches. But modern cosmology says it's the distance between the earth and the sun. But note, I find this interesting, two things. All cosmologies of the world were heliocentric or geocentric until Copernicus came along and said, no, no, no. Geocentric, the sun is the center, the planets are moving around the sun. That's the model. And everyone went, wow. And then here's the distance between the sun and the earth. And he was off by a factor of about 100. But he was using telescope. He had he was a smart guy. He developed a telescope. You could see the sun and then see planets in the sky. But he was off by a factor of about 100, my memory is right. And then telescopes got better and better and better and better. It got closer and closer and closer and closer to the Vedic number. And now the number is about a 1-to-1 match. So how did they know the distance? They didn't have technology. How do they know the distance? They can't, you know, with their eyes measure the distance. It's descending knowledge. And that same descending knowledge describes in a geocentric model, which we're hearing in this verse. Yatarkaha, like the sun, dakshinataha, from the south. As the sun moves from the south in its orbit, so also the king moved about the earth. The short summary is, they both work. It's just relative motion. So I had this discussion once at Stanford University, and somebody said, well, which one is it? I said, it's relative motion. You can calculate either way. I said, no, it's got to be one or the other. But why does it have to be one or the other? It's just a perspective. Well, it's either this or that. Said, what happened to relativity? You're a smart Stanford University student. What about, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, where it's either particle or wave depending on how you look at it? No, you're smart. No, it's got to be one or the other. Anyway, the Vedic perspective, the numbers work. One can predict astronomical events, cosmology events, according to the Earth-centered model. Everything, without elaborating. How is it possible? Again, it's descending knowledge. And because it's descending knowledge, we accept not only the math that turns out it works, but all the other information that we receive because it's descending knowledge, which we cannot. Empiric events like, you know, cosmology events, one can quantifiably or empirically state, even if you're not hearing descending knowledge. You can make some numbers and quantify things. But even quantifiable things are accurate for the same reason that things that are beyond our sense inspection, they're also accurate because it's descending knowledge. And then the last point is this word, Odayadver. It becomes an O because of the previous consonant, but it's Ada. Ada. What is it? A. Udaya. Adri. Adri, the hill, the mountain. So the sun is seen first from the Himalayas, or the high elevation place. You can see the sun before a lower elevation place. So the indication Prabhupada is taking is the kingdom of Pitu Maharaj extended from the highest place, the place where the sun is seen first, and boundary is all the seas. So in other words, he ruled the world. And that's what's said also. Bhuvi means the world, and mandala is the globe. Just in case there was uncertainty, saying it twice. This king, Ayam, Bhuvo Mandala Oyadre, Odayadre, he ruled the world. And including from the Himalayas to all the seas, everywhere. His vira, his prowess, was so great, he had no one equal. But that's the position of God. A word that Prabhupada used like hundreds of times, to indicate the position of God is he who has no equal and he who has no superior. And what's that word? Asamurdva. A sama, he who has no equal, and a urdva, he who has no one greater. Asamurdva. That's God. No, they're saying he's God. The previous verse they said he's God. Bhagavan Sakshat. Now they're saying it in another way. His prowess was so great he had no equal. There wasn't anybody greater than him, and there wasn't anybody equal to him. That's God. That's one of the six opulences of God, of Bhagavan. He has all strength. And he has such strength he had no equal. As the previous verse was describing Bhagavan Sakshat, he, Prithu, exhibited the opulences of Bhagavan in full, and here's one of them, strength. Goptaika Viro Naradeva Nataha. So he was the proprietor of everything. Boktaram Divatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. He's that person. And Prabhupada is saying in the purport, whether it's King Prithu or not a Shastivesh avatar, but a king, that king is to be respected in this way, Vedic culture. Problem is, there aren't qualified kings around anymore. And part of that has to do with there aren't qualified brahmanas around to train and guide the qualified kings. So it's an unfortunate circumstance. Therefore, the means, Bhagavatam just points these things out and says the means, therefore, is the process of sacrifice to make an unqualified person qualified by the chanting of the holy name done properly. Small thing. Okay. Any comments or questions? We count on Suja for two or three. A little louder.
So it is King Prithu that has not no competition, but he has his vast kingdom got expanded vastly, and you know, he's totally from his mind and brings all the decisions for God. So just wondering, usually there would be always a divine king during all those times. He didn't come any kind of.
There would be subordinate kings. There's an emperor above all kings. There were kings that would look after, and kings that would look after, and kings that would look after. And there's an emperor. That's the system.
So he didn't have any problem with those.
Right. They were happy to be under his protection.
And then my next question is about this reduction of the sun channels, not 5 or 6 months. So usually in South India also there are a lot of temples which we usually they have like two gates.
There are two?
Two gates.
Gates. Okay.
Like showing like telling us like okay, this is like Dakshina gate, Dakshina.
Yes, exactly.
Uttarayana gate.
Yes.
So they say that, but I was just wondering, what is the significance of this sun chanting? Because even in
that question related to 8th chapter in Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna just
went
to
the
Sun.
So
I
was just
like,
and want to understand, like, what is the significance of the
Sun chanting? It's auspicious. And that, one of the reasons why Makara Sankranti is by different names, but all over India, a big holiday. It's because it's auspicious. It marks the movement towards the north. It's auspicious. The 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, with a soul that departs, of course, that's one Bhishma Deva is not dependent upon such things. A Vaishnava is not dependent upon such things. But Bhishma Deva observed it. To set example for others. So he waited until that, and then he left. But the significance of it is, it's the path towards the higher regions, like heavens, not Vaikuntha, the path towards the heavens is opened in that period of time. For those who are dependent upon Shubha and Ashubha, auspicious and inauspicious things, that's auspicious. And the other is inauspicious. Because the sun is going down. The sun is going up.
So during this self-traveling time, the paths to the Amritana are not open, or...
I don't know the detail. I can't, you know, you dig and probe and try to go deeper in it. I don't know. I only know what I know. There are people that know. One of the persons that I asked a question of Gaura Keshava. Chakra, you know Gaura Keshava? You know of him. Okay. He knows all these things. You know, I asked him a simple question. He gave me, you know, over answered the question in all this detail about why we circumambulate the deity or Tulsi, keeping Tulsi to our right. If you keep Tulsi to your right, you're moving in a clockwise direction. Pradakshinaha. It's right in our prayer. Yani kani chapapani. Pradakshinaha. So same, the root word. And it's, I forget exactly. He said, you know, it may seem, because we're moving to the right, we're moving in a clockwise direction, but the sun moves in a counterclockwise direction. I forget exactly. It was like this technical yada, yada, yada thing, and I couldn't follow it. I read it four times, and I couldn't follow it. It's like so technical. It's just a technical. So, my brain doesn't go into those things. I can forward the text to you if you want. You can read it if you like technical things. But it has to do... I can't even remember. It's technical. It's an indication of auspiciousness. The path to the higher regions is open. As the sun is moving to the north. So yogis that aren't devotees and they're dependent upon Shubha conditions, they want that situation. But devotees that are depending upon the ultimate protector, they're protected by the ultimate protector, and so such rules do not apply to them. But someone that doesn't have the shelter of the personality of Godhead, such rules apply. What's important is, you know, not calculating an auspicious time for something or other. When to brush your teeth and, you know, everything. Yes?
In one of the lectures, I understood that there's two kinds of protection. Is that
right? I don't recall. Can you refresh my memory?
No, you mentioned it in one of the lectures.
I don't recall. My memory isn't what it should be. I don't remember. I can take a guess, and it was probably something within the commentary of our acharyas, like a detail. Three types of protection. Let me see if I can dredge my memory. How we should not
disturb you by devotees and give them protection, maybe from the devil.
different levels. Well, what? One type of protection is physical harm. That's one thing. You know, someone's strong and they protect someone from physical harm. Another type of protection is protecting another from their own impurities of desire. Like what Kashyapa did not do with Diti. She had an impure desire, and his right position would have been, should have been, to protect her from that impure desire, but he didn't. So there was an unwanted consequence from that. So then another kind of protection is, you know, the soul's shelter of the Supreme Soul. That's ultimate protection. So engagement in devotional service is that ultimate protection. So one who can see that those who I'm in charge of giving protection to, they're in the shelter of the Personality and Godhead, that's ultimate protection. It's incomplete just that, like Prabhupada gives the example, parents may wish for their children to get the best doctor and be very, very, you know, so they do things that don't get illness, best doctor to get an illness, but ultimately Krishna is the protector. We can do those things, we should do those things, but we should understand that's not the ultimate sense of protection. Or we can take precaution that we don't have any accident, but accidents happen. We're ultimately dependent upon the protection of the Supreme Lord. So one who is the caregiver to another, the best kind of protection is this protection, shelter in the Personality of Godhead. Let's just say somebody's in the hospital. So we want to make sure that they have the best physicians. We want to give them the sense of their being loved. So, you know, we're there and holding their hand and, you know, letting them know we're there for to support you. You're not a doctor. What can you do? But, you know, so they're more feeling the care and the affection of others. But then ultimately is, you know, reaching a Bhagavatam or chant and have kirtan and give shelter of spiritual sound. Those are different levels of protection. And we don't just do one and not the other two. We don't just chant and say, you know, see you later. We do all three. But ultimately, shelter of the Personality of Godhead. Chakra, you had something. What? I'm not sure what your question is. Like, you know, your birth and my birth, we're in the same boat. We were born in America. And, you know, the culture in which we were born into wasn't sattvic. Whatever it wasn't sattvic. And so, is that important? It's important, but it's not conclusive. Because by taking full shelter of Uttama Adhikari Bhakta, all of that can be nullified. So it's not a zero, but it's not a ten either. It's important, but it's not ultimately important. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya spoke, and Prabhupada referred to it so many times, all those who take birth in India have the duty of doing two things, making their lives perfect, and giving this knowledge to others. And Prabhupada would say to Indian, or to audiences in India, this is Lord Chaitanya's mandate. Unfortunately, you're not doing it, so we're engaging whoever will do it with the qualification of the chanting of the holy name and the purification from that comes from devotional service. But really, you know, you're the people that should do it. If I'm appealing to you, please do it. So it's important. If I've understood your question correctly. Have I understood your question correctly? Well, let's do this. There are devotee couples that don't have children or are in the process of raising families that are, there's young children, and they may have additional children. So those children aren't born yet. There are some children that will be that aren't born yet. Now, how important is it that the consciousness of the mother and father are very elevated, so that the birth of the child will be according to the consciousness of the mother and father at the time of conception? That's the particular soul that will be attracted, and their qualification to carry that soul to the stage of completion of the journey of the soul. It's important. That's another way of looking at it. It's important. But most important is the ongoing Krishna consciousness and the shelter and the personality of Godhead, aside from observing proper samskaras, like Garbhadhan samskara, the samskara of proper procedure or ritual to be observed before conception, which comes before the child is born, usually. Beginning part, the preamble is correct. Prabhupada was in an emergency situation. But the principle of the superiority of bhakti and how bhakti can act to completely reconfigure, you know, one's karma. The description is filled with it. Even sopamapyasya dharmasya, even a little bit of devotional service, it's even the chanting of the holy name done once is sufficient to eradicate all of one's past karma, the reactions of one's past sinful deeds. So that's not emergency, that's any time. The principle holds. Now, how Prabhupada engaged us, that was one thing. He gave unqualified people a lot of responsibility and the opportunity then to assist him. So if there's some adjustment, then the non-emergency case is we want to qualify people more before we give them some position of responsibility, because it's non-emergency. But the principle of bhakti holds then in non-emergency time. That is, the potency is there to completely rearrange everything. So then the question is, how much shelter is being taken of that principle? We were immature, and Prabhupada gave us responsibility that required maturity. Some did all right, some didn't do all right. But it was, the house was on fire, and grab a bucket. Is that all right? Yeah.
I might have a detailed question. So, all of the communities, for example, some persons in leadership position that many, many areas sort of fall away or reduce incentives and so forth. So,
the non-leadership position as well, you know, that all the different gradations of what people would do. So?
My question is, after so many years of having practiced Christian consciousness and that responsible position, what is it that, how to say this way?
I know what your question is. What's the cause or what's the prevention? Why, when that happens, what can we do to prevent that from happening to ourselves?
Yeah, what does that mean in green? Because it seems like...
Well, I covered this the other day, but I'll say it again. I'm happy to. Submission. When submission slackens, the material tendency returns. So make the connection with Krishna strong, and that's by pranipat. Submission, and submission to the representative of and to Krishna himself. Submission. That's one way of saying it. Another is offense. We want to avoid offenses. And then a third is complacency. I'm feeling comfortable. So when complacency is the case, then submission slackens. The flame diminishes. So the flame is our connection to the higher purpose of life. Not just maintaining, but achieving the higher purpose of life. Understanding what that is and continuing to strive for it. And continue and continue and continue. And if I become complacent, immediately Maya is there. No delay. Not like slowly. Immediately Maya is there. Immediately Maya is there. It's, you know, moving from our constitutional position to our conditioned position. The constitutional position is service of Krishna. Prabhupada explains it. This complacency thing is, you know, if we're participating in devotional service on the platform of the mind will do two things, accepting, rejecting, sankalpa, vikalpa. So for some time I'm accepting because I don't like suffering and I don't like, you know, the circumstances. I don't like being miserable. I don't like people being mean to each other. I don't like it. I want an alternative. So I accept. But then the mind, after accepting, will then reject. Prabhupada gives the example of people who work very hard, but then they want their vacation. So it's built into the system. They have 5 days of work, 2 days of, it depends on the culture, some days 6 days of work and 1 day of weekend. And then, you know, I want my vacation. I work so many days of the year and I want vacation because I take the fruits of my hard labor and I go and enjoy. It's like, you know, work and enjoy. Sankalpa vikalpa. The whole idea is to enjoy, but you know, the mind makes it look like this is work and that's enjoyment. Anyway, devotional service can be taken up in that way also. When I'm, you know, feeling the pinch, I'm like, you know, intently engaged in my activities of devotional service, and then things become nice again and it's slackening. Complacency. It's dangerous for bhakti. So those are some ways to look at what I should, that's how it happens, and I want to avoid those things. Because I don't want to be a statistic. So many, they have these signs, so many deaths so far this year on highways. And the number keeps growing. That's to tell you, you know, better drive safely. I don't want to be a casualty, so what do I need to do to not be a statistic? Person that started Krishna consciousness, and that therefore Bhaktisiddhanta used the language better, one moon than so many shooting stars. Shooting stars, glorious. It's gone. But lots of illumination. But then it's gone. That's not new phenomena. It's then the moon just continues to give light. Better one moon than so many shooting stars. That's Bhaktisiddhanta. And Prabhupada said, so I will consider my mission to, as my Guru Maharaj, I'll consider my mission to be successful. If there is even one moon-like disciple, then he said, but Krishna has been very kind and I have so many moon-like disciples. Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.